Hello and welcome to the latest in our centenary series of podcasts. Our very special guest today is Professor Richard Smith, former editor of the BMJ, who's in town to help us celebrate our 100th birthday. Welcome to Sydney, Richard.
Well, it's great to be here and congratulations on making it to 100. I'm sure there's another 100 to come.
Oh, we can only hope. You were editor of the BMJ for 13 years. Does it get any better than that in the world of medical publishing?
Well, I suppose it could. I mean, a lot of people would see The Lancet or The New England Journal as more prestigious than the BMJ. But it was great. I mean, I felt it was a huge privilege to be editor of the BMJ. And I suppose I was very conscious that I was a steward of the journal. You know, I took over a journal. It was my job to hand it on in at least some sort of decent shape. And I must say, I think Fiona Godley, who's the editor now, is doing a fantastic job.
The BMJ is very successful in terms of money making and in terms of global reach and online presence. What can other journals like the MJA learn from that in terms of balancing the needs of publishers and the needs of advertisers and the needs of academics?
Well, I think any journal has to start, you know, what is it we want to do exactly? You know, what is our core business? I mean, are we primarily about publishing, you know, first-rate science regardless of where it comes from? Are we primarily about Australia or do we want to be global? There are all kinds of tensions, and I think you've got to be very clear about what it is you want to do. And I would say, for example, The Lancet is very clear that it's very much about global health. In some way, it's a historical accident that it happens to be published in London. Has a fair bit about the NHS, but essentially it's very much a global journal. For the BMJ, it was more of a tension because there are something like 100,000 members of the BMA receiving the BMJ every week. Their focus is primarily on Britain, but at the same time with the internet, you've got more people than that all around the world accessing the BMJ. So you've got to decide what your priorities are. And I think one of the beauties, of course, of the internet is that you can have your cake and eat it. So if you look at the paper version of the BMJ, it's pretty focused on Britain, whereas the internet version, you know, the web version is much more global. So you can slice up your material in different ways and present it in different ways to different audiences. But I think you've got to be clear about what are we here for. And I suppose from where I sit to think, you know, the Medical Journal of Australia surely must be primarily about Australia, helping doctors in Australia decide what they think about things, grapple with the issues that are uniquely Australian. But at the same time, I suppose, there's lots of interesting stuff going on in Australia that the rest of the world will be interested to learn about and share.
Publishing, particularly in the news business, I suppose, but also in the journals business, is very much in flux at the moment. There's a whole tension between making money and loss of advertising revenue and all that kind of thing. Do you think medical journals still have a place? And if so, how do they survive this?
Yes, I mean, there have always been tensions around making money. I mean, I'm going to talk tomorrow about a lot of the earliest journals, almost all of which disappeared because they went bust. I mean, there's nothing unusual about that. There's always been a tension there. But clearly, I think that the impact of the internet, we haven't by any means seen all of it yet. I think we've got quite a long way to go. And I think there will be a huge shakeout of journals. And I think journals will come to be, well, in some ways different from what they are now. But I think particularly a lot of medical scientific journals have been primarily about publishing science. And I think increasingly that will be done on large databases rather than in journals. So then the journal has got to think, well, what are we here for? And I think you might say that, I mean, if you think of all the doctors in Australia, I mean, not many of those are going to be going and looking at databases of science to try and find things that are important to them. I mean, there's just a vast amount of material published. So I suppose one of the functions of the journal could be to kind of boil down that material and say, well, what of all of this really matters to the doctors here in Australia? And then try and present it in some very attractive, sexy way. Whether people are going to pay for that, I don't know, because again, there are lots of other ways of achieving that end, you know, increasingly electronically presenting things in a particularly engaging, attractive way. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with journals over the next 10 to 20 years. But generally, I mean, nobody knows exactly how many there are, but maybe there are 30, 40,000. I don't think there are going to be 30, 40,000 in 20 years' time. I think there's going to be far fewer. And it may well be that, for example, the Medical Journal of Australia, with its specifically Australian focus, is going to do better than many journals that are trying to compete globally.
Yeah. You practiced medicine before you got into medical publishing. What made you slide from clinical practice into this wacky world?
I mean, I never practiced for very long, which is probably just as well. I mean, I wrote an article entitled "The History of Surgery: My Contribution," which was one terrible disaster after another. So I think it's probably a blessing for people that I steered away from clinical medicine. I mean, one of the things that had a huge influence on me, I mean, I was a medical student in Edinburgh. I graduated in 1976, but in 1974, I went to a lecture given by Ivan Illich, who was very well known at the time, where he argued the major threat to health in the world today is modern medicine. And that quite unnerved me and blew me off course. But I have to say, I don't think he was entirely wrong. And it's very interesting to go back and read his book. He wrote two books, Medical Nemesis and Limits to Medicine. I reviewed one recently for the BMJ, sort of revisited it.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what he said rings very true. So that kind of blew me off course, and I decided I wasn't going to have a conventional medical career. I didn't quite know where I was going to go. But I had always, I edited the medical school magazine in Edinburgh. I edited the university poetry magazine. I edited magazines at school. I've always had a passion for the written word. So there was a sort of a negative element and a positive element that led me to be the editor of the BMJ. But there is an irony, of course, that I should be sort of blown off course and begin to think, well, perhaps modern medicine is the major threat to health in the world today, and yet to end up as an establishment figure, which is, whether you like it or not, that's what you are in Britain as editor of the BMJ.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people felt that I was a little bit anti-doctor, and somehow that's emerged more clearly since I since I ceased to be the editor. Because I blog all the time, and I must say I love to blog. I think it's a very I think that's, you know, and there are lots of people blogging entirely for free.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think in a way, this maybe sounds almost insulting to you, but, you know, lots of science journalists, for example, who, you know, have been some sort of scientist in the past, or someone like me, a medical journalist who was some sort of doctor, but not really, you know, that much experience. I mean, I suppose we got away with it because a lot of doctors couldn't grapple their way through the complicated systems of publishing and, you know, publish primarily to advance their careers. But now I think the ease of blogging means that you've got many very well-informed doctors who can write in a way that's very accessible and appeal to a lot of people, and similarly with scientists. So, you know, how much longer do we need those kind of intermediaries who take complex science and complex medicine and translate it for a mass audience? I think there are lots of people who are fully practicing doctors, fully you know, engaged scientists who can do that pretty well themselves.
Which brings us to the fraught question of peer review. Speaking as an outsider, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a scientist, I'm just the staff journo. But observing the peer review process and the submission process, it seems so clunky and so long-winded. Does it have to be? Does peer review have to be this hard?
Well, I'm become a complete skeptic when it comes to peer review. We started doing a lot of research at the BMJ into peer review because peer review, in my mind, is an interesting process because it's absolutely at the heart of science.
Yeah.
Not only in terms of journals, but in terms of grants and promotion, etc. And yet it was a wholly unexamined process,
yes.
Which is a paradox. I mean, it was a faith-based rather than an evidence-based process. So, I mean, I wasn't the first to begin this by any means. I mean, my predecessor, Stephen Locke, Drummond Rennie, you know, there were a group of people who said, we can study peer review.
Mm.
And what's, I think, been interesting about those studies is that they show very clearly the very substantial defects in peer review, and they have struggled to show the upside. So it's slow,
yep.
It's expensive. I mean, there are billions of dollars per year being spent on peer review around the globe. It's largely a lottery. It's very poor at detecting errors. I mean, we've done a number of studies where we inserted errors into papers. The first one we did, we took a 600-word paper, we inserted 8 deliberate errors into 600 words. We got a whole lot of people to peer review it. The median number of errors spotted was 2. Nobody spotted more than 5, and 20% of people didn't spot any. And yet these were pretty serious errors. It's prone to abuse. It doesn't detect fraud.
Yeah.
And so yet it's really hard to show the upside. I mean, people have tried again and again. And so I've come round to the view, certainly for studies, you don't, that the real peer review is what happens after publication.
Right.
And I don't mean, you know, comments that people write in response to the publication, but I mean the whole kind of market of ideas whereby people look at this, discuss it, and decide, you know, does this contribute very much or not. And I think the reality is that most of these studies just disappear without trace and make very little difference to anybody. But some do come through and make a difference. So I think that instead of having a selected handful of people deciding what should be published and what shouldn't, much better to let the stuff get out there and let the world get to work on it and decide what matters and what doesn't, which I would say is what happens in reality anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly when it comes to grants, you can't use that because you can't fund every grant.
Yeah.
You're going to have to make choices. But
when it comes to publishing, perhaps you just publish and be damned and let the chips fall.
And it sort of, you know, fits. So, you know, we have lived in a world of filter then publish, but increasingly, you know, it's much better, I think, to publish than filter. So, you know, I've been very involved with the Cochrane Collaboration and they find it very frustrating that actually, because of the rather random process of publishing, you know, lots of things get published in many different kinds of journals, sometimes with all the information there, sometimes not. Things don't get published. So trying to organise it all. And also, ironically, and I suppose in the end it's perhaps not so surprising, we begin to know that the top journals are much more likely to publish things that turn out to be wrong than lesser journals, which it perhaps isn't surprising because they're interested in the new, the sexy, and those things are often more likely to be wrong. But we now have evidence sort of showing that fact. So the sort of idea that you could read a few top journals and you'd know all you needed to know is clearly fallacious.
The fly in the ointment of the publish then filter is, of course, the mainstream media, because they latch onto everything like it's the next answer to cancer, to CVD, and they distort it for the public. So I don't know how you...
Well, you see, I don't worry too much about that anyway, because I think you'll find that a lot of stories that end up in the mass media, they're not coming from peer-reviewed journals. And also, I mean, if you are... Because, you know, universities are putting out press releases, crazy scientists are ringing up journalists. I mean, lots and lots of stories emerging from all sorts of dubious sources. I mean, that is the reality at the moment.
Yeah.
And the benefit of making everything available is that at least then, if you think, well, I open, you know, the Daily Mail and it says that porridge causes cancer. Well, at the moment, it's very difficult. I mean, I start from the assumption that's probably not the case, but I don't really have enough information to decide. If, you know, there was the tradition, there was a full paper that showed where this came from, then at least you can make up your own mind.
Yeah.
Because another major source of stories are sort of abstracts, presentations at conferences, where again, you haven't got the full data. So I think things are pretty damned imperfect at the moment. So I don't think they're going to be any more imperfect by, you know, a publish and then let the world decide. And maybe, in fact, the journalists would then begin to recognise that they shouldn't just report what came out yesterday. Because,
yeah.
I mean, we know that particularly many of the research in nutrition, you know, most of what's in medical journals is wrong, in a sense.
Yeah.
We know that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the things are not good at the moment, so I don't think they're going to... changing to this newer world is going to make things worse.
So has anything gotten better since you published The Trouble with Medical Journals in 2006?
Well, I mean, I very much... There's a big campaign at the moment, as you know, to try and get all trials published.
Ben Goldacre.
And I mean, that's undoubtedly a good thing. I think, too, that the sort of consort equator, these sort of guidelines on publishing that say if you're going to publish a randomised trial, then you better make sure that all of these 23 different things are there,
mm-hmm.
because it's clear that when you go back and look at trials, lots of the essential information simply wasn't there.
Yeah.
So I think that's been a step in the right direction. I mean, I'm very passionate about open access.
Yes.
And slowly but surely, more and more research is available to everybody everywhere, and I think eventually that will be the norm. I mean, it's going more slowly than I would like. I think too, probably, that journals like PLOS One and then subsequently BMJ Open and lots of opens, that makes a sense in my mind, that let's if we are going to do some peer review before publication, let's keep it pretty minimal and let's simply decide, you know, do we think the conclusions are supported by the evidence. Let's not worry too much about whether it's original or important, because we may not think it's original or important, but other people might. So I think there are things that are going in the right direction, but there's a lot that isn't, I suppose. I mean, I sort of looked at the influence of pharmaceutical companies on journals, and I think in many ways it's emerged over the years that's worse than kind of I understood at the time. So I think lots of problems around authorship and research misconduct, fraud. I think we haven't got to grips with that at all yet.
So it happens more than we think.
Yeah, I think it definitely happens more than we think, and I think we have evidence to that effect. And I think the tradition has been to sort of try and bury it. So I think Retraction Watch, for example, I don't know whether you follow Retraction Watch,
no,
but it's a fantastic thing. Yes, it's a group of guys,
mm-hmm.
who are looking at all the retractions in journals and finding out, you know, why was this paper retracted, and writing it up as a... You should certainly subscribe. It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, they send out about 5 or 6 a week. And I mean, it's presented beautifully. It's very witty. I think it's a fantastic thing, Retraction Watch. I think too, I mean, I was involved with the start of the Committee on Publication of Ethics, mm-hmm. COPE. And I think the way that it's expanded from a handful of journals to sort of 5,000, and also is looking not only at ethical issues of authors and reviewers, but of editors too, because I think editors have often been insufficiently accountable. Although many have been slung out, as we've been talking about.
Indeed. And, you know, perhaps the days of the editor coming in at 10 and answering a few letters and then going off and playing golf are not quite so frequent as they were. Tell us a little bit about the work you do in Bangladesh.
Yeah, well, I'm the chair of the board of trustees of ICDDRB, which used to be called the International Centre for Diarrheal Disease Research in Bangladesh. It's now called ICDDRB because it covers many more topics than diarrhea. In fact, the work on diarrhea has been a huge success. One of the things that ICDDRB does, there's a place about 40 miles from Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, called MATLAB, where every birth, every death, every emigration has been monitored for some 50 years. It's a remarkable database. It's about 250,000 people. And there hasn't been a diarrheal death there in a child since, I think, 2009 or something. I mean, there's still plenty of diarrhea, plenty of cholera in Bangladesh, but there are not nearly... the same number of deaths as there were. And in fact, what I'm specifically interested in is non-communicable disease, meaning heart disease, diabetes, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and common cancers. And MATLAB data show that if you, in 1986, NCD accounted for 10% of deaths. Now it's 80%. Wow. So it's a very rapid transition.
Because Asia is the growth area for NCDs, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, all low and middle income countries. I mean, that's where 80% of deaths from NCDs happen, in low and middle income countries, because that's where most people are.
Yeah.
And the rates, you know, whereas heart disease has been coming down in Australia and Britain and US for a long time, it's rising very rapidly in these countries. So, you know, that's, but as chair of the board, that's not my only interest. I mean, it's a, I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about quite a lot at the moment, which is relevant to Australia, is that for years, ICDDRB has had generous funding from AusAid. But the particular contract has come to an end at the moment. And I know that, you know, the AusAid budget here has been diminished. And so, you know, we've been talking a lot to people from AusAid, or what has taken over from AusAid, and we hope that that will continue. In fact, there's a particularly strong link between Australia and ICDDRB, particularly around demographers. So ICDDRB has been very strong on demography, and I know that ANU is very strong on demography, and there's almost always been a demographer on the board, and there have been lots of demographers from here who have worked in Bangladesh. So, you know, ICDDRB has done some remarkable things in the past. It developed oral rehydration therapy. A lot of big family planning studies were done there. A lot of cholera vaccine studies. And if you look at, I mean, Bangladesh, which is the poorest country in South Asia, or one of the poorest, has really the best health outcomes, much better than India or Pakistan, which are wealthier. And at least some of that is down to ICDDRB. But just as journals are facing challenging times, so are, you know, organisations like ICDDRB. So keeping it alive and flourishing is a challenge.
Yeah. Well, it's always a challenge keeping the MJA alive and flourishing. Are you looking forward to tomorrow?
Very much. I must say, I always enjoy to be in Australia.
Quite regularly.
Yeah. I suppose I've been here 10 times over the last 20 years. And I know a hell of a lot of people in Sydney, you know, not just through their sort of academic work, but as friends. And I was in Melbourne just a few weeks ago, and Melbourne's a great place too. I think of Sydney as the slightly kind of brash, in-your-face kind of place, and Melbourne is a little bit more sober. But
some would say a little bit more civilised, but that's my bias. Thanks so much for your time. It's a pleasure to have you here, and we're looking forward to your presentation tomorrow, which is called Scientific Journals from 1660 to 2060, From Birth to Death. So that doesn't sound very optimistic.
Yes, well, I wondered about putting in a question mark, and then I thought, no, let's just go for it.
All right. Thanks, Richard, so much.
Thank you. Bye.